Hey everybody. The podcast has been quiet lately. I'm taking it slow because I'm still raising this puppy. I'm working on my own stuff. And I dropped a brand new kitchen knife on my finger and almost chopped it off. It was very painful. And then things were getting better. And then I went to a lake house in Minnesota where I contracted a sort of mysterious microbe in my eye socket that I neglected for 5 to 7 days. And it turned into orbital cellulitis. And then I was admitted into the hospital for 2.5 days, given a variety of IV antibiotics and pain medication. So the eye is better, but apparently my kidneys might have suffered some lasting damage. And ultimately, my vision is still pretty blurred out of my right eye, so I think they call that a Pyrrhic victory. I'm not sure, but there's a certain point where karma catches up to you, and this might be it. So I'm just letting it wash over me. All right, enough of that. I'd like to give a shout out to my new patrons: Alex, Dimitri, Discussion Ready, Adam, Jaziel, Dalton, and Henry. I really appreciate you guys and the support. As always, I'm about to do another free book giveaway. For patrons, if you want free books, and if you want to get a helpful newsletter that I kind of put together just for myself, honestly, to inspire me to write and write well and stop wasting time, etc. And it's based on, you know, it comes from a few sources, but predominantly from interviews. I kind of take out the salient advice that I think is best from those talks and put them in a nifty little newsletter that you can print out and put on your desk and reference when you're feeling stuck. There's also exclusive content like interviews and stuff like that. So if you want to become a patron, you can have all that for just $1 or $3, depending on what you're into. So check it out. Patreon.com/selectedpros. Today's guest is Tao Lin. He's the author of Trip, Taipei, Richard Yates, Shoplifting from American Apparel, EEE, and more. His latest book, Leave Society, was published yesterday, August 3rd, 2021. About Leave Society, Brad Phillips had this to say. He called it a special and beautiful book. Melissa Broder, author of Milk Fed, calls it a warm, funny, hearteningly nonconformist book that changed the way I think about natural health, well-being, and the great mystery. It's a beautiful work of art. I loved it. Now, I haven't read every book or even a lot of books, to be honest, but I'm still pretty confident there isn't another one out there like Leave Society. It's so strange and hopeful and honest and serene and well-researched and, you know, as always with Tao, extremely funny, but I feel there's more love in this one, I guess. Enough of me. It's a great book. I hope you read it. I hope you send me a message and tell me what you think about the book, about the interview, and about, you know, your life and my eye. I'm always here. I'm always online. So, all right. Let's go talk to Tao Lin.
I see it. All right, I'm recording now.
Cool. Well, how are you?
I'm all right.
It's nice to have you on. You're in Hawaii, right?
Yeah, I am. How are you? How's Hawaii? It's pretty good. It gets really hot in the daytime, except if you're in the shade, then it's pretty cool.
Yeah?
Yeah.
When did you move there? Like 2020, right?
Yeah, in January 2020, I moved here.
And you finding it better than like New York?
Yeah, a lot better.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember what New York's like that much because before I moved here, I lived upstate for 2 or 3 years. But before
in upstate New York?
Mm-hmm. In upstate New York and in New Jersey, in a place called Pawling.
Okay.
Where are you right now?
I'm in Brooklyn right now.
Mm. You're in the NYU's MFA program?
Yeah, I am.
Nice.
And you went there for undergrad, right?
Yeah, I went there just for undergrad.
What'd you study when you were there?
I studied, my degree was in journalism.
Okay.
And I wasn't sure what degree to get. I just took classes that I liked, and I ended up having like 7 credits in psychology and eight in journalism. So I got a journalism degree, but I took like 11 creative writing classes.
Oh, that's nice. I wanted to tell you that I read Taipei and Leave Society in the last couple of weeks, and I have Trip here sitting on my desk for the future, because I kind of see it as like this connection between the two. But before we talked about all that, I just kind of wanted to talk, you know, specifically about, yeah, like your time at NYU, and I know that you like to express yourself artistically in like a multitude of ways, but sometimes because you write so much about the internet and you do it in such a clear way, I often find it interesting that you chose writing as opposed to like some other form of art. And I'd love to know about like early Tao and when that started.
Yeah, I think it started in middle school when I listened to punk music, bands like Rancid, The Broadways, Choking Victim, and I liked their lyrics a lot. I felt moved by a lot of them. And then I also started listening to quote unquote emo music. Mm. And their lyrics were less political and more about feeling depressed and lonely. Mm-hmm. And that resonated with me even more. So I just wanted to recreate lyrics that I liked at first. And I wrote poems. When I got to NYU, I took creative writing classes where we would write poems and really short stories. And I started submitting stuff there. And my teachers were grad students usually. Are you teaching?
I'm going to teach in the summer, yeah.
Yeah, nice.
Did you ever have any thoughts of like going down a more academic route with your writing? Or actually, before we go there, I'm more interested in kind of how your early poetry was received in those classes. Like, were you writing more kind of like similarly to your classmates back then? Or were you, you know, how did the teachers find your stuff?
I remember one teacher was really supportive, and she would tell me, like, you know, you're really good, don't you? And I'll just be like, I don't know. And I don't know how it compared to other students' poetry. I feel like my poetry back then was more, it was less direct and more hard to figure out. Mm-hmm. And I would steal some lines from bands that I liked or change them around slightly. And then the stories I wrote, I remember they were kind of violent. Like it would be set in an office or something and there would be murder. And I stopped writing like that.
You specifically address that, I think, in Leave Society, where you're like, yeah, most people's writing has murder in it. And I don't do that.
Yeah, Lee's, the main character Lee, his mom is saying that maybe Lee shouldn't write about child abuse. And then Lee's parents, Lee's like, other people write about worse stuff like murder and people love that.
Yeah, they do, for better or for worse. And it's really funny. You have this really interesting point too in Leave Society where, and I don't want to give too much about it away, and we'll talk about it in due time, but this general idea that you bring up at one point about like conflict and whether conflict is like necessary in story or art. I think you say at some point, you know, you don't like conflict is tension, and in a way it's like unhealthy. And there can be works of art that are like conflict and tension free that still have value, is something.
Conflict, it just makes it a lot more of a page turner. Mm-hmm. There's some kind of conflict, I feel like. But maybe that's just like an addiction to a certain way of writing that isn't necessarily helping everyone. But also there's different kinds of conflict. Like you can be in conflict with yourself or with your society. But the kind of conflict that Lee is critiquing is conflict with the people in his life. Because he's in conflict a lot with his parents in the novel. And because he's writing the novel while living it, he feels aware that he might be causing conflict just for the novel. And he's aware of that, but he wants to like be on guard for that. But still, it's probably impossible to like be totally not influenced by that, he thinks.
Yeah, since he's writing about his life, he kind of wants to create the necessary tension and drama, or maybe subconsciously like is creating it, and he's trying not to do that. And
yeah.
So when in like early in your career, 2006, 2008, when did you decide that like maybe something like autofiction, I guess is the term that people use, as opposed to something more like conventional narrative form, like when did that become apparent to you that you kind of wanted to write about your life? And
yeah, there wasn't that term autofiction back then.
Who invented that? Did you?
No, I didn't. I feel like it started appearing more in like 2013 or so. And I think a few critics wrote about it. Christian Lorentzen wrote about it a lot. And there's also a Japanese novel that came out. I feel like it came out in like 2000 or 2005 or something, called Autofiction by Hitomi Kanihara. And it seems autobiographical. But I feel like once I started writing, I was interested in writing about myself because of the wanting to write about feeling depressed and lonely. And then my first book was a poetry book, You Are a Little Bit Happier Than I Am. And that was really strictly, it was just like nonfiction. But then my next two books, Bad and EEE, those two are probably my least autobiographical books. I would only take a little of my life and then sort of collage it into made up stuff or other stuff. But then after that is when I started writing strictly autobiographical stuff in prose. And since then, I've just been doing that arguably more and more. Because I started writing nonfiction too, which is just strictly autobiographical.
Yeah, so it's like, at least from my perspective then, I mean, yeah, of course, like, you know, EEE and such in the beginning was probably far different than like Richard Yates or than like Taipei. But it seems like you made such a huge leap between, I don't know if you feel the same way, but between like 2008, 2010 Tao to like Taipei. Was there anything in particular like in your life or in that period that kind of ushered in what I guess like a lot of critics or what I personally felt was maybe just like a different level of your work?
Yeah, I was in New York and I was using a lot of drugs and feeling, I don't remember what I was feeling, but one thing I remember is that I was kind of annoyed by how everyone talked about me. Not everyone, but a lot of critics talked about me as writing really minimal, simple prose. And part of me reacted against that and wanted to write really complicated sentences. And not just reacting against critics, but also I was tweeting a lot then. And I wanted to write in a different way than I was tweeting too. So I ended up working on sentences for a long time. Complex sentences.
What about them saying like, oh, that this your early stuff or your sentences were like short or simple or whatever? Like, why did that piss you off? Did it seem kind of maybe like patronizing or like condescending or something?
Yeah, a lot of the time it was said in a derogatory way. And I also just felt misunderstood because in bed and EEE, I used long sentences and abstract language and metaphors a lot. People were just focusing on shoplifting for American Apparel and Richard Yates when they talked about the minimalism. But also, besides reacting against critics and what was the second one? The other thing, I also wanted to write something different after doing minimalism and shoplifting in Richard Yates. Because those two books, I also had wanted to do something different from Bed and EEE.
Yeah, that seems pretty characteristic for you. Like, I mean, I feel like you're always changing both your writing style and kind of it, from what I can tell from the outside looking in, like you're always changing your self outside of your author self, like in your life, like this journey between like your early stuff to Taipei. And then I think a lot of people they like to talk about like the drug use in Taipei or whatever, but it's when you're writing Taipei, did you kind of see there almost like utility at that point? Or was it kind of, you're just sort of partying and slowly your view on like psychedelics and stuff started to evolve?
I feel like I was just addicted to pharmaceutical drugs, Adderall and Xanax. And it just played such a big role in my life. Like I would just look forward to being on those drugs. And then the periods in between would just be like an interim period where I barely did anything. And then, but I was also excited about drugs. I liked feeling a lot different than how I usually felt and being able to go into social situations and be calm or confident. And I also liked experimenting with just feeling different, because I'd always been writing about my feelings, and the drugs like change how I feel and give me new feelings. So that was interesting for me to write about in Taipei, because Taipei goes a lot into memory and just fleeting emotions and trying to describe those things. And then that led to me using psychedelics. Yeah, just my interest in drugs.
Something that's interesting about Taipei to me is the meticulousness about how you document the drug use. And I think that continues. I mean, I think you do that a lot with your life. Like I listen to other interviews too, and you kind of like, you're up for, you know, you're pretty commonly like measuring things out and stuff. But like Taipei will be like, I took 20, you know, and forgive me if this is wrong, but like milligrams of Xanax, and I went to the party at like 7:04 p.m. And like a lot of the time, for whatever reason, Sam Pink once said to me, like, if you really just delve into any situation and like try to get at like what's true about it, it's often funny. And sometimes the meticulousness I find to be like very humorous. But I thought about maybe like what, like how you were documenting these moments in your real life that were coming into your fiction. Like if you were, say, going to a party as represented in Taipei in real life, were you meticulously like planning out like how much you would take and like how much 20 milligrams would affect your ability to do X, Y, and Z? Because that's kind of what it seems like in the book, which I find to be like a very interesting personality trait.
Yeah, I was. I feel like with drugs, it's important because I want to know, like, or I'm just always keeping track of it because I don't want it to get out of control. And I want to know what effect the dose I take is going to have on me, so I like know how much to take. And also in a lot of writing I've read, I noticed that writers will just put like, I threw a few pills in my mouth, or I had a handful of pills or something like that. And it just seemed not specific enough to me. So I felt interested in, like I was being original to some degree, to just be more specific, because it doesn't take more words either to be specific in that way.
And yeah, then, that's a great point.
Yeah. I like that Sam quote, Sam Pink paraphrase you had about, if you just write about what's happening, it's, what did he say?
He said it just can be kind of funny. Like he had this thing, yeah. He had this quote, I think it was in like Person or something, but it was just, it was like a guy touched a pole on a city bus and then like thought vaguely about like germs, and then about then he touched his eye, and then he wondered like if the germs got in his eye, and then all of a sudden he was like wondering if he had cancer. But you could tell that it was such a like a genuine train of human thought that he was just like, he's like, I was just documenting everything that I thought in that particular moment. And it turns out like when you do that, it can be funny sometimes, like just like how absurd our trains of thought can be.
Yeah, I feel like writers could trust their own lives more, because a lot of the times it seems like they'll think their life is boring or what's happening to them isn't worth talking about. Then they'll try to change it and then it'll seem false and just not funny anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I ask a lot of guests about this, but I definitely want to ask you, because I really find your work to just be like hilarious. I just want to know if you find your work to be humorous, or kind of like what we're talking about now, like factually documenting things to like the most specific degree. Like I kind of could feel that you were laughing along with yourself sometimes, but I'm never too sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I try to be funny. I try to make it funny. Yeah. Without that, it loses a lot. I'm trying to think if there's nonfiction I've written where I don't try to make it funny. Yeah, there is. I wrote an essay on Karen Wetmore, this MK Ultra victim.
Mm.
And I didn't try to make that funny, even though there were parts in it that did end up seeming kind of funny anyways. But I feel like in fiction, I've always tried to be funny. Yeah.
Yeah. Karen Wetmore, that, not to derail us too much about talking about fiction or whatever, but that comes up in Leave Society as well. That was a particularly like disturbing case. And I don't know, maybe you could tell people who don't know about it or haven't read the book yet, maybe like if you want to, like a little bit about that essay. Because I spent a day or two on the internet like reading about her, and it was extremely disturbing.
Yeah, I found it disturbing too. I found this book. It's a memoir she wrote called Surviving Evil. And I found it while writing Trip, when I was researching MK Ultra. I went on Amazon and searched MK Ultra and looked at every result, and this was one of them. And I read it, and it's about how Karen Wetmore, I forget the details, but when she was like a kid, I don't know why, but at school she was wandering around confused, and then they took her to the hospital, and she said, or she might have said this while at the school, something about if they send her home, something, she'll kill her mom. And then she was in and out of mental hospitals, and at some point in this process, the MK Ultra program or people involved with it like noticed her as being a good candidate for them to experiment on. And then I think when she was 18, she was put in almost continuous seclusion for like 8 months, and for like days at a time, she wouldn't get any water or food. And then she was also given electroshock therapy in a much more severe way than normal to try to erase her memory. And then she continued being in and out of mental hospitals and seemingly experimented on, like being dosed LSD and given this drug Metrazol, which is used in Soviet gulags, and it causes excruciating mental and physical pain. And then she didn't find out about any of the experimentation until she was like 45, I think, when in therapy, her therapist asked her to write a narrative of her life. And then she tried to get her hospital records from Vermont State Hospital, and they wouldn't give it to her. And then she got a lawyer, and then they tried for a while. And then when they finally got it, they realized from all the charts saying how long she'd been in seclusion and all this, that she'd been experimented on in MKUltra. And then she sued the state, but she had to stop the, just stop suing them because she was having heart attacks. And then finally she met this mind control researcher who has this independent press, and he published her book. And it hasn't been covered by any media, it seems. But there's probably like tens to hundreds of other people like her with similar stories that haven't even found out about it. But this occurs in Leaf Society because the main character, Lee, reads this memoir. And it just makes him think that something like that could just happen to anyone. Like, you could be suicidal for other reasons and then go to a mental hospital and just end up like this. And it represents a low for him in terms of what can happen to you in society.
Like a lack of control.
Yeah, lack of control. And then being, for example, in seclusion, having no idea why you're straitjacketed and naked. And also when her mom would try to visit her, the hospital people would tell her mom that she didn't want to talk to them and all this stuff. And she, while writing the book, she did a lot of research. And also before writing the book, she would contact a lot of politicians trying to get help for herself. And no one ever responded besides, she said, Bernie Sanders, like, sent someone to tell the FBI or something to stop stalking her.
Mm. Jesus. Is your essay out yet?
Yeah, it's on Medium.
Okay, cool. I'll definitely yeah, check that out. I feel like, like, first of all, what led you to get into that sort of research? But I just feel like your earlier stuff's been kind of like, people have talked about that a lot. And I don't know how much you want to keep rehashing old stuff, because I think that you've made like such an interesting change in the last three books. But I'm definitely interested in that period then between like fiction and nonfiction, like Taipei Ends and Trip Begins. And that period's covered in Leave Society, because you're talking about writing a nonfiction novel in Leave Society. But what was going on with you then? Like, why the switch to nonfiction? Like, what piqued your interest in studying like Terence McKenna and psychedelic drugs, as opposed to continuing down the Taipei path?
Yeah, with the Taipei path, I just felt like I reached an end with that, with the using drugs and having a kind of bleak worldview. And it was shortly before Taipei was published that I encountered Terence McKenna on YouTube. And he had an optimistic worldview that was convincing to me. And I was kind of, I wanted to find anything that wasn't depressing, that was all compelling. And that was something. So then after Taipei came out, I wrote a column on Terence McKenna for Vice, a nonfiction column. And then that ended up being expanded into Trip. But I was just really dissatisfied with my whole life when Taipei came out, with the stuff I wrote about in Taipei. Mm-hmm. The character is depressed a lot of the time, and his lifestyle wasn't sustainable. Like with the drugs, it just kept getting worse and worse, how he felt. So he wanted to get away from all that.
Did you, or Paul in the book, but did you feel maybe like his worldview was like, it was like a chicken or the egg thing, like his worldview was informed by the kind of life he was living, or vice versa?
Yeah, I think it would have, but I didn't leave the city till 2018. But I did feel like almost all my friends were still using a lot of drugs, and I just isolated myself in my room and started using cannabis a lot. And also drawing. And then one thing Terrence McKenna promoted a lot was reading, learning. So I just started doing more stuff alone in my room. And I think that accelerated my change.
In like a positive direction.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And then another thing Terrence McKenna promoted was psychedelics. And I was really interested in that because I was still interested in drugs and experimenting with consciousness. And psychedelics are like an extreme version of that, but without the addiction and feeling horrible.
Yeah, yeah, becoming dependent and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think if I remember correctly, like, you know, Paul in Taipei, he's using psychedelics, but maybe not in a way. Like, do you feel there's like a way to use them that might be maybe not the correct way, but more beneficial than, say, like going to Vegas on mushrooms or something? Like there's a line you can draw where one form of use can be beneficial to like your self evolution, and the other is just kind of maybe like wasted or something.
Mm. I feel like using mushrooms and going to Las Vegas could be beneficial. If you just use enough where you're still in control of your senses, like you could get a new perspective on all that. The way Lee uses it in Leave Society, sometimes he thinks it's not in control because he brings LSD to Taiwan, mm-hmm, and cannabis. And sometimes he just feels like he's using it too much.
And he's using it while staying at his parents' house in Taiwan and fighting with them. And I guess since we've talked about Taipei and sort of like everybody knows about Trip and it did really well and it's very interesting for it, and a nonfiction, Leave Society to me feels like a really like a combination of both of those books. I don't know if you feel the same way, but essentially, and please like, you know, tell me if I'm mischaracterizing it, but like Lee, it seems to me like it's more of a journey between an exploration of his relationship with his parents and health and kind of like the toxicness of the, like, I think there's a quote in there where you say everything is poison, but it's a way of kind of like, he's almost like reassessing how he lives his life, and it's much more family oriented. And so just for people who haven't read it yet, like, is that kind of a fair characterization of where the book starts off?
Yeah, yeah, I like that characterization. And I feel like I kind of view that in Trip in Taipei as a trilogy. Yeah, and Leaf Society is different than my previous fiction because of how much nonfiction it has in it. A lot of research, and I'll reference books and papers.
Yeah, there's like a lot of that, and there's a lot of like, I'm learning a lot about like microbiomes and on your Instagram, I noticed that you had found, you've been kind of like linking to the books that you read, mm-hmm, in the course of your research for Leave Society, and a couple of the ones that you shared had to do with this thing that comes up a lot in Leave Society, which I really wanted to ask you about, that you seem to focus a lot on, which is called Dominator Society.
Yeah.
Could you tell me what that is a little bit more?
Yeah. I heard about this from Terrence McKenna. He would talk about how people used to live in partnership societies. And he got this term from this social scientist, Rhianne Eisler. She wrote this book called The Chalice and the Blade, where she had a cultural transformation theory, where she argued that underlying society, the two points on the spectrum of the ways people can relate, in her view, are partnership and dominator, not, say, communist and capitalist or religious or secular. She points out that a communist society can be either partnership or dominator, and the same with capitalist societies. And she argues that humans used to be partnership up until 6,500 years ago, when for whatever reason, people just started conquering each other. And she argues that that dominator style has continued to this day, and that we need to look back before prehistory to societies like Catalhoc, where people seem to have lived in partnership. They didn't have war or defense fortifications, and they all seem to worship nature as a female deity. And Lee and I just find this way of viewing things inspiring and hopeful, and also just seemingly more accurate in a fuller worldview. Because before, I had never heard about societies before 6,500 years ago, because in textbooks we're taught that civilization started after that with the Egyptians and Sumerians. And yeah, you like that idea?
I do, yeah. I mean, I think why Leaf Society is so exciting as like a combination of fiction and nonfiction is because of it's such like unconventional knowledge that you're bringing into this book. Like, these are things that people don't talk about. Like, there's a lot about extinction events that like I had never heard of, like comets and stuff. And there's this, you know, there's almost something like, Lee is in a lot of ways, like with his family and with the people that surround him, like Socrates, in a way that it can be maybe exhausting for the people around him and exhausting for him to kind of have to be continually explaining like why we shouldn't have mercury in our teeth, or or the facts about like fish being like, it's I kind of want to ask you, like, on a personal level, like, this seems to be maybe like a new intellectual pursuit or interest for you, but it has to be hard, like, learning all this stuff about the world and like continuing to, like, I mean, you don't have a lot of options other than quite literally like leaving society.
What's
for you internally when you're like, you know, you're already, as we talked about with Taipei and stuff, you're already so meticulous about your intake with your coffee and your drug use and stuff, but once you start learning these facts about like dominator society, or about how like the extent to which like our daily lives are filled with poisons and toxins on a practical level, like, how does that affect you kind of like on a day-to-day, or how does it affect Lee in his day-to-day? Does it stress you out? Like, does it make you more anxious, or are you more at peace with the knowledge that you now that you have it?
It does both to me, because learning about how toxic everything is, that's hopeful, because then it explains why I'm so depressed and why life feels horrible. Like, before, it just, people are just like, that's how life is. But then I learn more and more evidence that there's modern reasons why it would be that way. And I feel like I do kind of have to be careful with what I read, because there's some stuff that I feel like if I read, I'll be convinced of it, but it'll be something I can't talk to anyone about, because they'll just think I'm crazy. There's stuff that, like that.
It happens to Lee a lot, or even worse in the book or in real life, is that people aren't really listening, you know what I mean? or like that your dad's taking, or Lee's dad's taking the same medication again once he goes back to New York for 2 weeks and he comes back and everything's sort of regressed back to like before they had their talks about health. But it still seems like a fight worth fighting.
Yeah, yeah. And when people, like with the Lee's dad, it also teaches Lee patience and patience, because it's just like his dad is relapsing on this drug and his doctor is like the drug dealer or someone like telling him to go back to it. But that shouldn't like discourage Lee. He should just know like people change gradually and change back and forth. And it's a challenge to Lee to try to explain things to his parents in a way that they'll understand it, instead of in a way where he'll just alienate them even more, which is hard.
If you don't mind me asking, in real life, you know, I feel that even though like Lee gets mad at his parents and stuff, obviously there's just like generation gaps, but the extent to which he makes the effort to, at least in Lee's society, like I think his relationship or Paul's relationship with his parents, but so I don't have to keep saying this. I'm let's just go back a little bit. Like you're writing autofiction, or as it's been called, but the narrators change names like throughout the books, but presumably I think anyone reading it would just like assume that it's based almost entirely on your life. So what gives between like Paul naming the protagonist Paul versus Lee? Is it kind of use a separate name to think about?
Yeah, I think it's easier for me and also for my readers. And it also just underscores that I want to, that like, or it just gives people a way to talk about the years 2014 to 2018 in the characters in my books based on myself. Like if I name them all just my name, then I don't know. I still like to view each book as its own thing with its own style and everything. And I do still also like to have a distinction from fiction and nonfiction. Just because, or partly because in my fiction, I'll feel free to move things around so they're not exactly like they occurred in real life, or I'll feel free to edit some dialogue.
Give yourself a little like breathing room, basically.
Yeah, but in nonfiction, I feel it's important to be exactly strict. Like in Trip, when I had exact dialogue, it would be dialogue I had recorded. Partly because I feel like that's important in nonfiction, because the order in which things happen is important if you're researching, like, I don't know, like some crime.
It's very,
yeah.
You couldn't just, I don't think you could just be making things up.
That makes
sense. The only reason I ask is because I don't want to keep saying like Paul, Lee, presumably you, whatever. But going back to kind of like his relationship with the parents in Taipei, he's getting these like long emails from his mother, like berating him for like any form of drug use. But it seems like not only the relationship with his parents, but his mother's relationship to like his drug use kind of evolves over time. And since your writing is so explicit, and like, I'm just curious on a personal level, like, what was it like having your parents first start reading your stuff that involved like all this drug use? And like, are you able to talk to them now about the stuff that it seems like you talk to them about and leave society, psychedelic drugs and these types of things? Like, how's that relationship changed over time?
Yeah, I talk to them about psychedelics. When I first started using pharmaceutical drugs in like 2009, I think I wasn't talking to my parents that much, and they lived in Taiwan already. So I feel like they just started noticing from the internet. And I don't know where I talked about using drugs, probably in articles and I had an essay called How to Give a Reading on Mushrooms.
Yeah, I've seen that.
So they just heard about it online. And my mom was just really worried. And I would get really upset when she expressed any worry to me. And then when I started stopping using pharmaceutical drugs and viewing myself as addicted, they were really happy because my mom was afraid I would die or something. And then I explained to them about natural drugs like cannabis and LSD, that they were safe and all that. And my mom read my column on Terrence McKenna, so they understood all that. And they're glad I changed from pharmaceutical to psychedelic drugs.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that they seem to have like gone along this journey with you, though. I mean, I'm not saying that they're doing drugs, but I did see a photo on Instagram where you're like introducing my dad to cannabis. But in a lot of ways, like in Leave Society and the characters in your universe, your parents' arc is honestly like the most interesting to me. Or like one of them for sure, because I don't know how many people could have those types of conversations with their parents, or at least like my parents wouldn't let me drive them around to like several different dentists and like get in arguments with dentists and like that. I don't know. I don't think that would happen.
Yeah, it was a weird combination of things that led to that. My mom has always been really supportive of me, and my dad has always said like they should listen to me. And then I was just living with them, and it was only me and them too. So I had so much time to just promote stuff to them. And then growing up, my mom had always stressed health a lot. She would always be doing things for our health. So when I started telling her, like, this is what be good for our health, she was open to that. And then I just had never given them that much attention before, and they liked getting more attention from me. And they got it through this, by working on health and by being a part of my writing. And for some reason, they've never been like worried about me writing about anything about them. Maybe partly because they're in Taiwan and aren't connected to the literary world at all. Yeah, it was a unique opportunity, I felt, to have so much access to them and to have them both know that I was writing about them and have them be encouraging of it and even looking forward to me writing about it.
Yeah, so what was the period of your life then when you were writing Leave Society?
Well, it takes place from 2014 to 2018, and I wrote it from 2014 to like 2021.
Oh, wow.
You know what I was doing while writing it. But I was living in New York City still and just visiting my parents for like 2 or 3 months each year while writing it. Yeah, okay, moving away from the stuff in Taipei, that whole worldview and the drugs and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And also something else I haven't mentioned is moving more towards nature. I had never paid attention to nature that much before encountering Terrence McKenna.
What would you recommend people read by Terrence McKenna? I mean, I know a lot about him, and I've heard lectures and such, and I know he's always thrown around with like Alan Watts, but what are some of his particular like writings and such that you would recommend to the Terrence McKenna beginner?
I think I would recommend listening to his stuff first. Or at least that's how I encountered it. Like, you can just search on YouTube Terrence McKenna, and you could try some topic you're interested in. He might have something. But getting closer to nature, it's kind of hard. I've just tried to pay more attention to trees and leaves and read books about Aboriginal societies, how they lived, and the natural drugs is one way learning about natural drugs and gardening and doing stuff like meditating instead of something involving technology. Mm-hmm. That also feels to me like getting closer to nature. And then natural health is a way, because natural health is this way of dealing with health where people just use natural treatments instead of drugs or surgery.
And do you have like a lot of faith in that? Or have you seen, because I mean, in Leave Society, like some of it seems to work, like your parents, like your mom's losing weight at some point and she puts it back on because she has, I forget exactly what changed. But have you seen some pretty like promising results after making the switch?
Yeah. I've been interested in natural health for a long time though, like since I was like 18.
Oh, okay.
I had natural health all through the drug phase. Like I would be drinking green smoothies and trying to eat healthy. And yeah, I found it really compelling and useful.
Yeah, I remember in Taipei, you talk about how part of the, like, part of the benefit of natural health is, it's not necessarily, because someone's like, are you afraid of, are you just eating healthy because you don't want to die or something? And you're like, no, I don't give a shit about dying. He's like, I just like to, it feels better.
Yeah. Some people think that I want to live a really long time, but it's just so I can be in a better mood. Mm-hmm. Like I remember in college feeling depressed and anxious and thinking if I should go on antidepressants, and then just
did you ever?
No.
Because of the research you found, they were like, they're just like terrible for you and they'll make your life worse.
Yeah, I don't know when I encountered that research, but at first researching, I just found like easier ways, like exercise and stuff that people recommended. And I just tried that and liked it better.
Yeah. That's interesting. Well, I mean, it's cool to me how Leave Society is, like you said, kind of this blend between fiction and nonfiction. And it's obvious that like a lot of research went in there. And would you categorize it as maybe like, you know, your favorite of the books that you've written? You have a favorite?
Yeah, I guess it's my favorite. Yeah.
You're like most proud of this one? I really enjoyed everything I've read, but this seems kind of like, again, like change being a big part of your life. This seems like yet another, I don't know. It's recognizable as your work, but it's kind of on like on another tier. And I don't know if you felt the same way.
Yeah, I definitely worked on it the most, and it's what I would be most interested in reading right now. And it just uses everything I've learned through all my other books.
I've heard you say that before in interviews about when you're like going through editing, or maybe when you're stuck or something, the question that you ask yourself is like, what do I want to read? Is that still a technique of yours?
Yeah, I try to do that. I try to do that, but I feel like I've thought that somewhat less as I've started writing nonfiction, or just including nonfiction and fiction too. A lot of the time I'm thinking like, how can I share this information without losing too many readers? And how can I share it so it will be understood by a reader in the same way that I understood it?
And like would want to like digest it.
Yeah. Because what I would want to read in terms of nonfiction, it depends on what I've already read. So I can't think like to write what I would want to read, because it would assume that my readers had all read everything I'd read. Like you have to go like incrementally with certain things. If society at large doesn't already agree with you, like depending on how extreme the thing is you want to convey, you just have to move gradually towards that.
Would you categorize some of the arguments in Leave Society as extreme? Do you think the average reader will find some of Lee's decisions to be like quite extreme?
Yeah, some people probably. Yeah, some people, I don't know, not everyone's as into natural health as Lee. And the stuff about the ancient partnership societies and people used to worship of female deity. I feel like a lot of people are open to that, but there have been people who have told me, I've written about that in Trip too. They've told me like that was pseudoscience.
What was pseudoscience? That like people used to worship a female deity?
Yeah, that whole thing. And then what else in Leap Society? He writes about, or he talks about the Big Bang not being a good theory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how open people are to that. Pretty open, I think. And then what else? What was stuff that you didn't find compelling?
Well, it's funny, before I started even reading Leap Society, or like you in general, I would always try to articulate my feeling that I had no research behind, that like I was never eating any real food. So for me to like read about the extent to like which you've clearly researched that like we are kind of fucked and there is like a reason why everyone feels like shit all the time, actually can be, it's like extremely cathartic for me. So I was probably more receptive to this than say like a lot of this stuff made sense to me, but like just to give I guess people a sense of like how Lee operates or like what the writing would be like, I highlighted this particular paragraph on page 46, but like he's just having a normal conversation with his mother. And then he says, Lee said modern people should feel unhappy due in part to toxification. A 2005 study by the Environmental Working Group, a nonprofit with the motto "Everything is connected," had found an average of 200 types of industrial compounds, including car emissions and banned pesticides, in the umbilical cord blood of American babies, he told his mom. Lee had suspected since middle school that he was constantly being poisoned and or that he was cursed. You know, and it's like, on the one hand, that's like funny because it might seem to somebody like melodramatic. And then on the other hand, it isn't, because you're citing like actual studies. And these are just things that people don't want to hear. Like maybe people won't challenge the assumptions as much as just not want to hear it.
Yeah.
I could eat fish more easily before I learned about like microplastics, for example.
I feel like, yeah, it depends on how you view this information.
But yeah, all that is to say that it's not that I didn't find it compelling or anything, or that I don't think people will find it compelling. It's just, I think it's like, it's cathartic in the sense that I feel that you're bringing stuff out that people kind of feel but might not have the words to articulate or the time to research. And then it's kind of like laid out for you here in this wonderful relationship with like a son and his parents. And we're kind of faced with the catastrophe that is the modern world.
Was there anything that you found like just suspicious of or anything though?
Suspicious of? Let me see.
Yeah. Or like,
I guess I'm trying to find it, but there was some paragraph about Lee has some quote about how nature, like there's a cow involved. Anyway, it's something about how nature minimizes cruelty, I think is the quote. And I thought about that for a while, like whether that could be true, because like nature itself can be pretty cruel.
Yeah.
Depending, I guess, on how you define cruelty. But I'd love to know, you know, maybe that kind of rang my skepticism bell a little. I was like, I don't know. I mean, it seems like nature can be quite cruel. But what's your thinking on that? Or what's Lee's thinking on that? If you remember, I mean, that's just like one sentence in a 300-page book. So I don't mean.
I remember that because a lot of people do point out how cruel nature is, like how animals are eating each other just so they can live. But I just wanted to make the opposite argument, that it's people and technology that ends up being cruel. Because as cruel as nature is with animals eating each other, those animals probably don't feel that much pain. Like they go into shock and are eaten, and prior to that they lived like free, happy lives, presumably. And even with cats, where a cat will catch a gecko and play with it for like 20 minutes before eating it, that's pretty cruel, but it's still only 20 minutes. Like compared to stuff like concentration camps and people on life support for like a decade routinely, like at the end of their lives, and just on like 5 different drugs and feeling horrible all the time, it seems less cruel nature than culture to me.
Mm-hmm.
Or I just like making that argument.
Yeah, I mean, there's a character that's mentioned in the book too, who like suffers on life support and has all his ribs broken multiple times just to keep him alive.
Mm-hmm.
He whispers at one point in Mandarin, like, I don't want this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, get rid of me. Like, so yeah, I mean, I think that's like an interesting point. And it does seem kind of, it's always kind of fascinated me too. Like if you watch the nature documentaries, like when a lion catches a gazelle and it sort of collapses, you have this beautiful description of like animals going into shock and leave society. And it's like kind of like this anesthetized, like dreamlike state or something. But it is kind of cool how it does sort of seem sometimes like nature is like almost was, it's like built into the code of how it operates, is kind of like an assumed painlessness, that it's not, cruelty is not the point really. It's just, it's like a cycle, and that the any additional pain or like torture or whatever has no purpose in that system.
There's no torture, it seems, unless you count animals that play with their prey before eating it, but the playing doesn't last that long.
Yeah, 20 minutes is doable.
Yeah.
Well, it's cool. I mean, I feel like personally, I was telling people about this book last night, and I feel like it's coming at a time where we feel culturally the most sick that we've ever felt.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you agree, but I feel like people are, you know, my hope is, or my expectation would be, that people are going to find this to be really cathartic when reading it, or at least affirming. I don't want to keep you too long, but I also want to talk about some of your tweets, because I think, how do you think things are right now? And like, do you feel like people will find Leave Society to be as cathartic as I did, maybe?
Yeah, I think I found it cathartic to write. And I don't know if people will find it cathartic. I think it depends on the person. I'm curious about what you're saying, though. Do you think we have similar views on something?
Well, just like, so for example, you tweeted about the, what was it the other day? I don't think it was MK Ultra, but it was like a CIA paper about
the way
that they've defined conspiracy theory, or like this idea of the conspiracy theory meme that like automatically undermines the very like premise of a conspiracy theory. You know, just, it's like I forget the name of the logical fallacy or whatever, but it basically, you can't even have a conspiracy theory anymore, because the phrase itself is meant to indicate like an insane person. And what you're so good at is not just saying that and like just, but you like actually like in Leave Society or with that tweet, like citing a paper, and in that way affirming what we know. And then I also want to talk about UFOs, but first let's talk about the CIA and this idea of like turning conspiracy theory into a meme.
Yeah. I had heard about the CIA having something to do with the term conspiracy theory. And then I finally researched it and read this paper by this PhD student. And he figured out that the CIA was part of, they had a big role in promoting this term conspiracy theory to mean something ridiculous that you should be ridiculed for looking into. And they did this in 1967, I think. They put out a memo to other people giving them strategies to deal with people who were questioning the official narrative on the JFK assassination. And the tactics were like, point out that such a big secret could never be kept, and attack the people that are promoting so-called conspiracy theories and so on, that seem to have just been implemented by media to this day.
Mm-hmm. Of course, because then you like you look at that paper that you provided to everybody, and it's like, we've all heard like those tactics reiterated at like barbecues or whatever. Like, we've all heard people say that those exact things, that the government clearly intended them to reiterate.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you search this, there's even an article saying that it's a conspiracy theory that the CIA had a role in this term, conspiracy theory. But if you read that article, it exaggerates it. It says that people think the CIA invented the term, but they didn't invent it. They were just one entity that promoted it a lot. There were two people who also promoted this term in this way.
So they basically just mischaracterized the entire argument in writing that second article, and then...
Yeah, well, they said some other stuff that didn't make sense to me. I forgot what it was, so...
Yeah. I know, well, it's just like an era. I don't know how you feel personally, but like, you are someone who's conducting a lot of research and stuff, but
mm-hmm.
It does seem like an era where it's nearly impossible to figure out what's actually occurring.
Yeah, it's pretty hard.
Do you ever feel just like at swim and just kind of like, I'm never going to figure this out, or I'm never going to figure out what is in my food because Google is in with the pharmaceutical companies or with the pesticide companies or whatever, and they hide the search results? Like, do you ever, you know, how do you find yourself staying sane in these research projects?
I don't think it's that bad. I feel surprised actually in how much info I can find and how easily, like, I can just go a few books into any topic and find like that the mainstream view on it isn't accurate,
mm-hmm.
and that the accurate views is more complex and hopeful.
Hopeful.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. For example, on UFOs, like all the UFO stuff coming out since 2017 has viewed it as a threat to national security, and that's not hopeful to me. That's, it just seems like the military is being allowed to deal with the UFO thing, whereas there's so many other aspects of it that could be put at the forefront. And then just what I've learned about UFOs and aliens and found compelling is more hopeful. Because from the stuff I've read, I feel convinced that they're peaceful and that they want to be in contact with humans, but they can't because there's the militaries of the world and possibly worse that are hostile to them and want to use their presence for their own agendas. For example, to increase their budgets, which they can do if everyone thinks UFOs are a threat.
And not if they're just something to be kind of like in awe at or potentially friendly. Yeah. Doesn't have the same effect.
Yeah. What do you think about UFOs?
I've always believed entirely in them, yeah. I'm very skeptical of like the way that it's being talked about now. I mean, not so much in terms of like the military and all that, but just maybe it's the cynical part of me is saying like, why are they highlighting this information now? And probably it's because they're sneaking something nefarious and horrible in the budget so that we don't pay attention to the right news or something. But yeah, I mean, I think it's like a really interesting time for people who are interested in UFOs and like extraterrestrial life. What are your like specific thoughts on it? Like, how long have you been interested in it? And have you seen a UFO? I feel like vaguely there's like a reference to that in Taipei.
Oh yeah, as a kid, I thought I saw a UFO when I was on a plane, but I felt like I more just wanted myself to have seen one. I don't know if I saw one actually. And since then, I don't think I've seen one. Besides one time walking on this road, I saw this really tiny orb, like this really, really tiny orb float by in the air. That might have been a UFO.
Like off in the sky?
No, like under me. Really tiny, like the size of a What's something really tiny?
A pea?
No, smaller than that.
Oh, okay.
The size of an ant's head.
Wow.
Yeah, really tiny. I don't know what that was. It could have just been something in my eyes or something.
Well, there's a whole chapter dedicated to that kind of phenomenon, right, in Leaf Society about the micro fireflies. So
Yeah.
There's also, I'll send this to you if I can find it, but there's a really great memoir about like a Nobel Prize winning scientist, chemist, who mm-hmm. like encountered aliens in California and then basically maybe like 3 or 4 months later was supposed to accept the Nobel Prize.
Hmm.
And so he couldn't come out with his story because the Academy would have revoked it. But he swears by it, and he had a lot to do with like certain developments in DNA and stuff. And it's really interesting, but I don't know. It's a cool time for us to be alive now when like UFOs are an actual topic of discussion, but it certainly like lends credence to all this stuff we've been hearing about for the last 100 years about sightings and everything.
Yeah. Have you seen a UFO?
No.
Hmm.
But I would like to. And I still maintain hope that we will like make some significant factual developments interacting with aliens and stuff in the next year or so, I hope.
Yeah. Have you heard of this researcher, Stephen Greer?
Only from your Twitter, yeah. That talk, the 3-hour talk he gave?
Yeah.
I still haven't listened to it, but I would like to. I will, definitely.
Yeah, I found his stuff really compelling.
And he was what, a former Navy? Is he a former Navy guy or is he somebody else?
That's someone else. He's just a doctor. He used to be an emergency room doctor. And he just started having contact with aliens as a teenager. And he developed this way for you to meditate and contact aliens and guide them to you. And he does this in groups. And he's also the main person trying to spread the message that he thinks that there's a secret group that wants to hoax an alien invasion.
Interesting.
And that this is all, or the last 70 years has all been for that agenda.
And would the goal be to like make them look bad for military purposes?
To make the
aliens like look like a threat? Is that their like ultimate goal?
Yeah. And then they'll be able to, Stephen Greer argues that humans have made UFOs and that all the videos in the past few years have just been man-made UFOs. And then they'll be able to like blow up a building or something with those UFOs, and then like the whole world is going to be like, we must put more into military spending and all that. And then,
and like fight our common enemy.
Yeah. And it seems like militaries are just addicted to that kind of thing. Like with the war on terror, it just increased their budget by like so many more times. And yeah.
And just like all the like ancillary benefits that people have, like private corporations and stuff, like outside of that, and all the people becoming like independently wealthy and such. But
Yeah.
But all of the stuff you're like exploring through your writing, and you say you're writing about aliens too. I don't know how much I should look into that or not. But if you're writing about aliens, I'm really happy to hear that.
Yeah. I'm not sure what I'm going to write about next yet, but I've been reading a lot about aliens and trying to figure out if it can be a nonfiction book or maybe a science fiction book.
Yeah, that'd be great. I mean, all your writing from that I've read, it's like made me a more attentive and like aware and oftentimes like genuine person, and I'm very grateful for that, and super excited for Leaf Society to come out. I just think that people are gonna love it, and thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for reading all those.
Oh my God, my pleasure.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening to another episode of Selected Prose. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Tao Lin. Find me on Twitter @SelectedProse, Instagram @SelectedProse, Patreon.com. /selectedprose if you would like to contribute to our cause and get some fun stuff in return. I'm also pretty excited to announce that in the near future, I'm going to be publishing some short fictions from our recent reading series solicitation. We got some great audio recordings, and I'm excited to introduce you to some great stories by some authors you may not have heard of. So all that and more to look forward to, and I'll be with you again soon.